Life sustains itself by cell division. So does cancer. Breast cancer cells multiply faster because of CDK4/6 proteins. But what if we could block those proteins and stop runaway cell division? To that end, Dana-Farber scientists laid the foundation for CDK4/6 inhibitors, new drugs that are increasing the survival rate for many advanced breast cancers. Dana-Farber's momentum of discovery keeps finding new ways to outmaneuver cancer. Learn more at DanaFarber.org/everywhere.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. This economy in Jay Powell's five favorite macroeconomic words. Here we go. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Wednesday today, the 4th of May. Good as always to have you along, everybody. You know, the funny thing about the big economic news of the day, the Fed raising interest rates half a percentage point, was that there was only really one tidbit of actual news in the news, and the interest rate increase wasn't it. You knew it was coming. I knew it was coming. Wall Street knew it was coming. Businesses knew it was coming. So on this Fed Day, on this program, something a little bit different. Jay Powell, in his own words, five of them, his most used economic words from today's press conference. Word number one, of course, it's the biggie.
2% inflation.
Inflation.
Dealing with inflation.
Powell's big worry, the thing keeping him up at night. Price stability is the Fed's whole ball game right now. Powell basically said as much today. Word number two, what the Fed is going to do about word number one. And how?
Our tools don't really work on supply shocks. Our tools work on demand. Precision surgical tools. Policy tools. Famously blunt tools. What our tools do. Using our tools to deal with it.
Tools, interest rates, shrinking the balance sheet, telling people what they're going to do. Forward guidance is the word Powell likes to use for that. The Fed's tools, limited though they may be, because he wants to manage people's word number three.
Broadly in line with expectations.
Look at short-term inflation expectations.
Our expectations. Again, our expectation is consistent with our expectations.
People's expectations are still being affected by
supply constraints, supply chain. Disruptions to supply have been larger. Labor supply remains subdued.
Supply chain, right? And finally, not to be forgotten, Jay Powell's fifth economic word of the day.
The labor market has continued to strengthen. The labor market is extremely tight. Strong labor market conditions. The labor market is, as I mentioned, very, very strong. Labor market conditions have been widespread, moderate in the labor market.
Kind of a riff on our old game show, what is Jay Powell thinking in five words or less, right? That's what the Fed chair had to say about this economy today, which, by the way, he did say is still really strong. Word number one aside. There was a moment in Chair Powell's press conference today when Wall Street sat up and started to really pay attention. It's when Powell said, yeah, no, unless something changes, we're good with raising interest rates half a percentage point a couple of times this year, not really thinking at all about 0.75%. That was the real Fed news of the day. 75 basis points, 0.75% is off the table. And as you'll hear when we do the numbers, traders really liked it. But the fact is, that since Powell and the gang at the Fed started talking about making money in this economy more expensive, which is what raising interest rates is, right? The major indices have been a bit soft. All right, a lot soft, really. And you know what? Fed's probably not mad about that at all. Maybe even counting on it a little bit. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore now on the Fed and the markets.
So it's not that the Fed tries to drag down the market.
The Fed does not make policy, and they're very clear about this, does not make policy based on what equity markets are doing.
Tim Mahidi is a senior economist at KPMG.
I used to work at the Fed, and I can tell you that is 100% true.
But the stock market is one way that higher interest rates can get people to spend a little less and take a little pressure off of inflation. Here's how it works from Bill English, who used to oversee monetary policy development at the Fed and now teaches at Yale.
So if people's wealth goes down, then they want to replenish their wealth. They want to save more, so they spend less.
Pretty simple. People see their investments sink, and their stomachs also sink, and they're less inclined to spend extra money. And the less people spend, the less pressure on prices. But there is a limit to this effect. Kairong Xiao is an associate professor of finance at Columbia Business School.
If you lose $1 of your wealth from your stock investment, on average, people cut their consumption by 3 cents, which is very small.
To be fair, the S&P 500, for example, has lost $2 trillion worth of market capitalization this year, so the consumption effects aren't nothing. But yeah, it's not a particularly strong phenomenon. On top of this, families are in pretty good financial shape compared to the start of the pandemic, so they have an extra cushion before they're going to start to dial back spending in a meaningful way, says Brian Bethune, an economist at Boston College.
And so if we have a correction in the stock market, 15%, that's not going to make a big impact on household net worth.
This is all one reason why the Fed has a long road ahead of it as it tries to control inflation. There's a lot of strength in the economy and the housing market, and it'll take time for it to all cool down. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, look out above. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The April jobs report comes out Friday morning. We did get a sneak peek today, though. The private payroll processing company ADP says the economy created 247,000 new jobs last month. But we should tell you there is sometimes a good-sized disparity between those two counts, ADP and the Department of Labor. Of note today, though, was this. Bigger businesses, that is with 500 or more employees, created most of those new jobs. Companies with less than 50 people actually gave up a net 120,000 jobs. Marketplace's Justin Ho explains what's going on there.
So far this year, sales have been pretty good at Rothmans, a men's clothing store in New York. Co-owner Ken Giddens says a lot of people are buying clothes for the first time in years, but it hasn't been easy.
Now we are working all the time because we can't find enough people to staff our stores.
Giddens says the stores raised pay to retain its roughly 40 employees and lure new ones. To find them, he's reaching out to friends and advertising his openings on job websites. So far, he says it's been frustrating.
We're getting some resumes, and then we're seeing this new phenomenon where people are ghosting us after making interviews.
Small businesses are at a particular disadvantage when they're competing for workers against big businesses with more resources to attract and retain employees. Glenn McDonald at Washington University in St. Louis says that means they can just offer more to prospective hires.
It might be just directly in terms of wages and salaries. It might be through improved benefits or better work or more career development.
And with the job market as tight as it is, McDonald says big businesses basically only have two pools of potential workers they can draw from.
And it's going to be either smaller businesses that don't have the wherewithal to offer greater pay and greater benefits, or by pulling people into the labor force who presently aren't working.
If small businesses keep having trouble finding workers, they'll have trouble growing, says Karen Kerrigan, CEO of the Small Business and Entrepreneurship Council.
And then that has an impact on the vibrancy of the economy, the competitiveness of the economy, and also the willingness of other people to start businesses, on entrepreneurship in general.
In 2019, businesses with fewer than 50 employees employed a quarter of the overall workforce. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
Spare a thought here, would you? Or a couple of thoughts, really, if you've been following the news out of Shanghai. For the 25 million people there in the fifth week now of a lockdown, by which I mean actual lockdown, not what we called lockdown here at the beginning of this thing. The goal, say Chinese officials, is zero COVID. Cases in the financial capital of the second biggest economy in the world are back under 10,000 a day. So some companies that had to close have been allowed to open back up again. But getting back to work is no easy thing. Marketplace's Jennifer Pack in Shanghai has that one.
The toughest thing for businesses during Shanghai's hard lockdown is getting official permission for workers to leave their apartments. Minnesota-based 3M hires 1,700 factory workers in Shanghai. The president of 3M's China operations, Ding Hongyu, spoke to reporters recently.
It's estimated that only about 50% of our employees meet the requirement for them to be back to work.
To qualify officially, workers just need to live in a building that hasn't had any COVID-19 infections for the past week. In practice, building supervisors decide whether to let workers out, and some have not in the past. People who can leave get tested a lot. Alibaba grocery chain Fresh Hippo's vice president is Shen Li.
On a daily basis, all the delivery riders must receive two antigen quick tests with 8 hours between them and at least once a nucleic acid test for every 24 hours.
Employers are also required to house and feed factory workers on site within a sort of bubble system. Another problem for companies is logistics. 3M's China president says his firm used to contract out its truck deliveries, but the government has now issued passes for 3M to do this itself. This doesn't work well for us, he says. Logistics should be left to the professionals. And there's another big uncertainty for companies. If a single COVID case is found among the workers, would that mean they'd have to close down for a week or more? In Shanghai, under lockdown, I'm Jennifer Pak for Marketplace.
If you were listening real close during my interview with Ambassador Catherine Tai yesterday, and if you missed it, by the way, podcast. But anyway, Tai is the U.S. Trade Representative, and if you happen to hear it, you might have noticed we didn't talk all that much about tariffs and China. So let's take care of that right now, shall we?
Back to China for 1 second.
Okay.
And the tariffs. I'm sure you're aware of the research out of the Peterson Institute, You Smile, talking about how there could be a calculated way to reduce inflation if we get rid of some of those tariffs. Mm. I don't want to discuss the methodology, but is it unrealistic to think that maybe tariffs have to be on the table if we're worried about inflation? Jen Psaki has said it. Secretary Yellen has said they're on the table. You have not said anything.
I have to engage in the methodology because that's where you started your question, which is the Peterson Institute study. And when you describe it that way, you're bringing the Peterson Institute's credibility into the conversation and the premise. The issue is that if you look at their methodology and you look at how they think that inflation can be addressed through using trade tools, they are assuming a world and a U.S. economy that has zero tariffs. So here's the thing, which is in our world, for as long as we have been regulating commerce, we've had tariffs in some form, right? Every country still has tariffs. We haven't always had inflation. And so I really have to challenge the premise of that study. And I think it's, either something between fiction or an interesting academic exercise. But with respect to the real pain that people here, Americans, but actually people in large swaths of the world right now are confronting with rising prices.
Right.
What I would say is this, which is, yes, we need to be looking at our economic policy tools across the board. You want to look at tariffs? Sure, let's look at tariffs. But also let's look at monetary policy, fiscal policy. All of these tools you need to look at. But here, I'm going to bring it back to tariffs, I promise you. Which is this. In terms of our trading relationships and in terms of our relationship with China, redesigning globalization 1.0 to take us to 2.0, that is a medium-term challenge that we have. Whatever sets of tools that we deploy to address the challenge we have right now, we have to deploy with a view to the medium term, and we need to make sure that whatever we do right now, first of all, is effective, and second of all, doesn't undermine the medium-term design and strategy that we know we need to pursue.
I want to be clear here, right? You mentioned monetary policy. The Fed meets next week, right? Or this week, sorry. Rates are going up. So monetary policy's been taken care of. The fiscal boost from the pandemic, all that money is running its way through, right? There's no more money coming from Congress. I want to make sure
there's always more money from Congress, but okay.
Says the politician. I want to make sure I understand you. Trade policy is on the table with inflation. Tariffs are on the table.
Okay.
I'm asking you a question. Oh, are they?
I thought you were telling me. So, look, it's a...
Well, look, you said okay, so I'm going to say yes. Ambassador Tai says yes, they're on the table.
So, I mean, tariffs are the traditional trade tool. They're a revenue raiser. They're a traditional way of regulating trade, right? So, sure, we can look at those tariffs, right? But I'm giving you the lens, the strategic lens through which we need to be looking at.
I appreciate the lens. You're not answering the question. Are they on the table or not?
Are they on the table or not? All tools are on the table.
Okay. Okay.
The question is, what do you do with them?
That's not my job. That's your job.
That is my job. That is my job.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Catherine Tai, the U.S. Trade Representative, and me yesterday out at the Milken Global Conference in Beverly Hills. Coming up.
People are not as convinced that they're going to control inflation.
I mean, that's fair, right? First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial is up 932 today, 2.8%, 34,061. The NASDAQ picked up 401 points, almost 3.2%, 12,964. The S&P 500 gained about 124 points, almost 0.3%, ended at 4,300 on the nose. Thank you, Jay Powell, taking 75 basis points off the table. Starbucks steamed up 9.8%. Today, the coffee chain's first quarter profit met analyst expectations and revenue came in slightly above. Airbnb grew 7.3%. The online lodging site posted a smaller-than-expected first-quarter loss as travel rebounded and COVID-19 waned. Bond prices were up. Yield on the 10-year T-note, 2.94%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. If, as now seems likely, the Supreme Court overturns Roe v. Wade and abortion protections at the federal level go away, there are going to be more unplanned or unwanted pregnancies. And as Marketplace's Stephanie Hughes reports, that'll have economic ramifications for both parent and child immediately and in the long term and for the wider economy as well.
Lori Bertram Roberts has given birth to 7 children. All of them were unplanned pregnancies.
I have a condom baby and I have a vasectomy baby. My mom was like, just don't even shower with the same soap as a man, please, because every time I turned around, I was pregnant.
Bertram Roberts, who uses they-them pronouns, had twins at 16, was pregnant again at 19, and couldn't afford an abortion. After dealing with pregnancy complications and being homeless for a while, they eventually finished school and now run the Yellowhammer Fund, which provides aid for abortions in the Deep South. But Bertram Roberts' own financial difficulties lasted a long time.
In the last 2 years, we just got out of poverty, and I'm 44.
Research shows Bertram Roberts' economic experience is not unusual. A study by Diana Green Foster of UC San Francisco found that people who sought an abortion and were turned away were 4 times as likely to live below the federal poverty line as those who did get abortions. She says one woman in her study summarized the findings perfectly.
She said, it's very, very difficult to find a job when you're pregnant, to keep a job when you're pregnant, or find to maintain a job with a baby.
And when these individuals can't work, there are ramifications for the whole economy, says Sarah Miller, who teaches business at the University of Michigan. She's worked with Foster to study financial outcomes for women who've sought abortions.
If you have a scenario where now you have large swaths of women who no longer have control over their fertility, especially right now when a lot of employers are finding it difficult to hire, you could imagine that that would have consequences for businesses as well.
Some opponents of abortion argue there should be more financial help for parents. Patrick T. Brown is a fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center.
There's a responsibility for policymakers to be thinking about subsidizing the cost of parenthood and making it easier for people to balance having a kid and, you know, being in school or being employed or, you know, having a more flexible work-life arrangement and those sort of things.
Brown supports the child tax credit and expanding child care options. In other words, when one branch of government acts, it's time for another branch to step up. I'm Stephanie Hughes for Marketplace.
We did the Fed word cloud thing up the top of the program, kind of an impressionistic approach to monetary policy, I suppose. Had to shake it up a little bit. But something else Chair Powell said at his press conference today caught our ear.
It's a risk that we simply can't, we can't run that risk. We can't allow a wage price spiral to happen.
To be clear here, Powell said there is no sign we are in a wage price spiral, but clearly he is a tad bit worried. A wage price spiral is just like it sounds. Rising wages drive companies to raise prices, which prompts workers to demand wages that are higher because prices are going up. So companies raise prices more so they can pay those raises, and so on and so on. And obviously, once that cycle gets started, it can be hard to stop. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman is on explainer duty today.
I wanted to understand the connection between wages and prices in recent periods of high inflation. So I checked in with Notre Dame economic historian Tom Stapleford. And like a good historian, he said,
maybe if it's helpful, I could go a little bit further back.
I figured he meant after World War II or the American Revolution. Nope.
4,000 years ago in the Code of Hammurabi, so ancient Babylon, tried to set prices for hiring animals, to how much you would pay to hire a cart, pay for surgeon's fees for wheat or for grain.
Stapleford says back then, wages and prices were kind of the same thing. In our modern economy, these two can get out of hand if there's a classic wage price spiral.
As consumers are worried that prices are going to rise in the future, first of all, they're going to try to purchase things right now because they want to lock in something at a price, existing price before it goes up, but they also are going to push for higher wages.
That's what happened in the 70s and early 80s, when the level of inflation we've seen for the past few months dragged on for a decade.
I think we are in a wage price spiral right now.
Columbia economist Frederick Mishkin is a former Federal Reserve governor.
If workers start to expect inflation to be higher, they have to ask for higher wages in order not to fall behind the eight ball. It's great if you get a 5% wage increase, but if inflation is expected to be 8%, you can buy 3% less goods next year.
He argues the Federal Reserve failed to act fast enough to keep prices and wages down.
When you're in a situation where the central bank loses credibility, people are not as convinced that they're going to control inflation. It's exactly a time when workers and firms are going to end up with higher wages.
Some analysts, though, think we're not quite in a wage price spiral.
I don't think we are necessarily entrenched in one yet, though I think the risk is very clear and very present.
Investment analyst Ross Mayfield at Baird, which is a marketplace underwriter, says what's driving inflation right now is principally pandemic and war, not wages.
You know, many people understand that this is both COVID-related and Ukraine-related. Long-term inflation expectations are still reasonable. They are not outside of the norm yet.
Then there's the camp among economists that says there's not much risk of a wage price spiral now or anytime soon. Joseph Bruswellis at consulting firm RSM says workers simply don't have the clout to push wages higher and higher.
This is not a wage price spiral linked exclusively to inflation in the way in which we saw that during the 1970s.
When labor unions represented one in four American workers and their contracts set the pattern for wages across the economy.
Back when unions played a much larger role in the economy, many contracts were tied to inflation. In the late 70s, the United Mine Workers were able to extract almost a 12% increase in pay in 1 year, linked specifically to inflation.
Bruswellis points out hardly anyone except retirees get automatic cost of living adjustments anymore. And he says companies have been able to pay higher prices for their supplies and pay higher wages to attract workers without hurting their profit margins. Evidence to him that the pressure to raise wages isn't hurting employers or the economy.
Higher wages are a good thing in the American economy and not to be feared. And as we move forward, that can't be repeated often enough.
He says the Fed should focus on fixing the price inflation side of the equation and let Americans' wages keep rising. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, it's kind of economically big picture in a geeky kind of way, honestly, but good, I think, to be aware of. The latest reading on the trade deficit came in today, the difference, of course, between what we sell overseas and what we import, and it hit a record in March, almost $110 billion more worth of stuff coming in than going out, about which this, back in the before times, the trade gap was pretty steadily between like $40 and $50 billion a month. Here's a moment of economic context as we depart. Chair Powell gave this a brief nod this morning. The job openings and labor turnover survey that came out yesterday, JOLTS, it's called. My bad, by the way, for not getting it in the show yesterday. In this economy in March, 1.9 job openings for every job seeker. 1.9. Our media production team includes Brian Allison, Jake Cherry, Drew Jostedt, Gary O'Keefe, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, Juan Carlos Torrado, and Becca Weinman. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.